Well, good morning. Thanks for coming. I'm Neil Chase from Federated Media, and I've got four people up here who are what we're calling independent successes, people who started something, stuck with it, built it up, got through the hard times, and the day they all wanted to quit. We're going to challenge them all to tell us about that day in a little bit here. But I want to introduce each of them and just start with a quick idea of how this thing came to be, how you ended up doing what you're doing now. Just a quick couple of minutes on the history, the background, how we got here, and then we'll talk a lot more about sort of the challenges of running the kinds of businesses they do. We'll start with Monish. Monish Bhatia runs two entire empires. One is in the auto space, Left Lane News, and the other is the MacNN network, MacNN, Electronista, iPodNN. And if you can do both stories in a couple minutes each, tell us how you got into these two businesses.
So about 12 years ago, I was in med school, and I was actually kind of bored, to be honest. And it's not a I started blogging. I started this website about Macs, and back then, those were the dark days. There was no one around. No one talked about Macs. Apple was sort of a sob story, and I had a Mac. I'd bought my first Mac, I think, the Apple IIgs, which was, you know, back in the 80s, and I kind of loved my Mac, and I started the Mac site in med school, and it kind of started growing quicker than I could handle, sort of on the one-hour nightly post. So I ended up leaving and doing MacNN full-time. And 3 years ago, I started Left Lane News. It's a car site. I started that with one of my former employees, and that has since also taken off. So I've sort of really enjoyed doing both, and they're both sort of growing, and they're kind of morphing from a blog into a magazine. And we have a big staff now, big meaning more than just one person, which was me before. Both of them were kind of stumble upon successes, and I was just really happy to be here.
So a promising medical career dashed, or at least put on hold for a long time. Can anybody name the first blogger and when? Any guesses, ideas, thoughts? We have several people up here who claim to be that person, so we're trying to challenge them on it.
It must have been Dookie.
So Manish, you started in 1996?
1996.
That's the offer on the table. Can anybody beat it? All right, you're the world's first and oldest blogger. Congratulations. Danielle has been doing this for over 4 years now. Danielle Friedland runs Celebrity Baby Blog. That's Friedland, not what the sign says in front of her. Take us, if you will, from criminal justice student to corporate person to independent blogger.
Well, when I was 16, I decided I wanted to be in the FBI, and I spent like the next, 7-8 years going towards that goal. But it didn't quite work out that well, and I just ended up at Avon Products as an executive assistant at their corporate office, and I thought I was going to eventually go somewhere, but it just took 4 years of me just kind of going in every day, hating my job, realizing nothing was ever going to happen. But I didn't start the site to get out of it. I started the site because my husband had created his own blog, The Food Section, about a year before, and I was a blog widow. I would come home from work, and my husband would go on the computer and work on his blog, and we'd eat dinner together, and then afterwards he'd be on the computer again. So I tried a knitting blog, I tried a personal blog, but I just thought they were really boring. I've always hated personal blogs just because, like, how many people are going to read them? I mean, of course, in Heather Armstrong's case, like, millions and millions of people, but most people don't have anything too interesting to say, I found over the years, and I'm not claiming I was the first blogger, but in 1995, I started a site called Natalie Engel's Chest of Lust, which was kind of an art project, but also a thinly veiled autobiography of my obsession with a certain tall, lanky, brooding guy. Anyway, one evening, my husband and I were watching the Golden Globes, and I was pointing out all these different people who were pregnant or just given birth, and he was like, "That's it. That can be your topic." And I was like, what? Celebrity babies? Who else besides me is interested in this? And it turns out, I guess about 3 million people a month are. In the beginning, it was sort of like this creepy niche. But, like, now everybody's obsessed. Like, everybody I talk to has an opinion on whether Angelina's carrying twins or not, or like even, you know, people who profess that they're not interested, they all have an opinion on whether Suri Cruz is Tom's baby or L. Ron Hubbard's. So I started that 4 years ago, and I have a 2.5-year-old daughter. I was doing the site before she came along, but she actually allowed me to leave my job because I went on maternity leave and was like, hell, I'm not going back to this crappy job. And I was able to basically start working full-time on the site and realize that I don't ever have to go back and work for somebody else if I don't want to, because my husband was working, I was able to work from home part-time, and then as the site just started taking off, I just started working more and more, and my husband quit his job in October, and so I'm the breadwinner right now.
Is that like the two levels of milestones in the independent blogging business? One is when it becomes your only source of income, and then one is when your significant other quits their source of income?
I had told Patel that, like, you know, that I was, that was my goal, and I was like, okay, in January, I want my husband to quit his job. And it took another 10 months to do it, but, I mean, just the fact that we can do it, you know, and I can kind of put him on an allowance is pretty cool.
Needless to say, he's not in the room today.
Yeah, he's taking care of her. The upside of that is, like, he's home with our daughter now, and she's not feeling well, so daddy's there to take care of her instead of, like, the nanny or daycare.
Well, thanks. So Ken Fisher, who until we talked about this thought he was the world's oldest blogger, you're into year 10 or so with Ars Technica?
Yeah, we started Ars in 1998. It was a diversion. We were bored. I was in graduate school at the time. I'm ashamed to say that I'm actually still in graduate school, and probably will be for another 3 years.
Graduate school.
Or maybe I'll just be kicked out, actually, at this point, because I spent too much time on ours.
You should explain, it's not just your average graduate school, right? It's one you've all heard of?
Yeah, well, although ours is a very technical publication, I have this dual life where I put a cape on and I read ancient Christian literature. I study the last form of the Egyptian language called Coptic. I'm earning my PhD at the Graduate School of Arts and Sciences at Harvard. Earning is in quotes.
And Jill Fehrenbacher from Inhabitat. Jill, what year is this for you on the site?
This would be my fourth year.
Tell us about the first year, or the year before the first year.
Yeah, so I have no claims at all to be the world's oldest blogger. I kind of got into this a little bit later than...
Perhaps the world's greenest.
Yeah, maybe that one. So I guess in some ways it's, my story is a little bit similar to the three of you guys here. I left a job that I didn't like very much, and there was grad school involved at during my beginnings as well. So I actually, I was working for a marketing agency as an interactive designer. I had studied fine art when I was in college, and I was very passionate about art and design, and, you know, had very idealistic notions about changing the world and, you know, working in the Peace Corps and kind of trying to make the world a better place through the power of design. And then I ended up, somehow, 3 or 4 years later, I found myself designing banner ads for credit cards that were just, you know, it was an interesting experience, but I kind of one day took a look at myself in the mirror and I was like, what am I doing with my life? I can't believe I'm just, you know, spending all my time designing like American Express banner ads.
Junk mail.
So, yeah, exactly. So I'd become very disillusioned with what I was doing, and it wasn't at all what I had set out to be doing when I got my kind of training and background in art and design. So I decided that I wanted to quit my job, and basically I started my blog and spent about a year doing it while I was still working as an interactive designer. And I think that background obviously helped me because I put together my own website and kind of knew a little bit about how advertising, banner advertising and that sort of thing worked. And I also decided to go to grad school at the same time that I started my site. So I decided to go study architecture, which probably wasn't the best decision when you're starting a blog, because I didn't realize how much work a blog is and also how much work architecture school is. And at some point, after about 2 years, I realized that I couldn't do both at the same time. So I took a little hiatus from architecture school.
One had money coming in, one had money going out.
Exactly. One had lots of money going into it, and I didn't know when the return was ever going to be from that. So.
And now you're having that return. So yeah. We want this to be open. If anybody has questions, please jump up to the mics and feel free to jump in while we're talking. You don't have to wait till the official 14-second Q&A period at the end. I think everybody's familiar with the sense of, I had an idea, so I started a blog. I was obsessed with something, I started a blog. I figured there was this one thing I love to do, love to follow, so I started a blog. What I want to get into is how we get from there to the next level. Each of you has stuff happening on your sites now. Like, all four of you are sitting here right now, and your blogs are not on hold. They're being published. They're running. There are people who work for you who are helping to put stuff up, to varying degrees for each of you. Talk about the time you went from a one-person operation or a two-person operation to the next person. Like, how did you make that decision to, I'm going to have one more person join me. It's going to be a huge expense. It's going to take a lot of effort. It's a big commitment to, okay, this is a real business now. How'd you kind of make your first hire and work that person in? Anybody?
Well, for a couple of years, I wasn't paying anybody but myself. And people were doing it for free and because they loved the site. They did it for the affinity of being associated with the site, even though it wasn't so big for a long time. And then I only recently started paying people about a year ago. But, I mean, I learned that at Avon. People, like, there's, most Avon representatives make barely anything, but they do it because they like to be associated with a brand that they believe in. So I think, and I still underpay a bunch of my people right now, but... hopefully that will change soon. But I do employ two people full-time and one other person mostly full-time, and everybody gets to do it mostly because they enjoy it. But my first person, she came to me about 7 or 8 months, I think, after I started the site. And in the beginning, it was just a hobby. I didn't start the site with the intention of making a lot of money, and I think that's what... one kind of misstep that a lot of people do now. They say, okay, I'm going to make $1 million because this other person is doing it. So I've seen a lot of copycats in my field who just say, okay, well, Celebrity Baby Blog, must be making a lot of money, so I'm going to do everything they're doing. And I think that's a major mistake.
You're one of the world's leading generators of cease and desist letters for people stealing your stuff.
Yeah.
Who else, Ken?
So with ours, it was quite similar. We had about 7 years of publication happening, where there was actually no one officially working on the site. I was at the time still going through my PhD. I was taking it seriously, at least, and everyone else was very involved. So we made our first hire actually in May of 2006. So it took us a long time before we took that step. And the reason wasn't ever really the money. It's that when you have your baby, it's very difficult to put other people in charge of it and to trust those people. And, I'd like to think that we weren't hasty.
Seven years doesn't sound hasty.
But I look back now and realize that I should, it would have been nice if we had done that 2 or 3 years earlier. Because the site has grown dramatically since that time. But it's very difficult, actually, at least for me, to bring people on without just vetting them to the point where they want to stab me. but you have to do that. You really have to do that, at least if your focus is on... With ours, we're very focused on quality and technical analysis. And you have to put a lot of time in those people, but it works out. And now we have 7 full-time people at ours now, and a body of about 15 freelancers. And everybody's totally integral to the success of the site.
That's great. Let's take a question over here on this side. Maybe we can turn up the lights just a little bit.
Hi. So I run a blog as well that I've been running for about 9 months, and it's something I'm really passionate about, and I would love to be where you all are at some point.
What's the site?
Boinkology. Okay. It's a blog about sex and culture. Okay. And so, I understand like the basics of how you grow an audience, and that it's kind of a slow process at the beginning, and like you get things that are going to go viral, and you keep building this, that, and the other thing. But what I'm actually really interested in knowing is, A, at what point do you decide that you have a big enough following to begin the monetizing process? And what are just the first steps of beginning that process? Like, how do you approach advertisers? Do you wait until people approach you? And, yeah, just any advice that you guys have on that.
What's your traffic?
In January, we got 100,000 page views. And it's been steadily growing. February, we hit the front page of Dig in January, so in February it was less. But we have been growing steadily, and we get probably an average of about 2,000 page views a day.
Are you doing Google AdSense?
No, not at present.
That's the thing to start with, I think, for sure. I can't speak for everyone here, but for me, it's something that really happened organically. I mean, when I first brought someone on and was trying to pay them a little bit, that was kind of the impetus to go and try to start bringing some money in. Mm-hmm. And Google AdSense, I think, is the sort of the most obvious and easiest place to start, because you don't need really high numbers. It's pretty easy to set up with. It's not something where advertisers are, you know, buying campaigns, or I mean they are, but it works in a different way than, like, you know, standard banner.
You just turn it on and it starts.
Exactly. Right.
And if you find somebody who will sell ads for you, like a 20% commission or whatever, like that's, they can worry about it. You don't have to worry about it. But what I always tell people is to do a survey of your readers so you have some kind of demographics, because even if you want to, sell to some, like, small company making whatever, some literature or some sex toys or whatever, you have to tell them something about your readers. You need to tell them how many are men, how many are women, what their, you know, ages are. And unless you know that by asking them, you really, like, no one would want to even talk to you, even if you promised to have millions and millions of readers a day.
There's a free service some of our authors have started using called QuantCast, which will do some of that for you for free, and it just gives you their demographics based on a panel.
Thank you.
And over here. QuantCast, QUANTCAST, QuantCast. You just go sign up for free, and they start tracking it for you, and it looks really funny for a month or two until the data gets real, and then you can actually decide it's useful.
Hi, my name is Rhea Becker. I have a blog for baby boomers called The Boomer Chronicles. And similar to that question, I'm curious, with Mr. Bhatia, I figure you've got car and Mac ads, but with the other three, what kind of people advertise, what kind of corporations or companies advertise on your blogs?
And what kinds do you like or not like or want to get or don't get?
Well, at ours at least, we have a real challenge because we're kind of split. In the business, we talk about B2C and B2B, and ours is both.
Meaning?
Basically advertising for consumers and advertising for business-related purposes. It's difficult when you're in that position because you have to juggle, a B2B campaign from Oracle against a B2C campaign for headphones or something like this, and targeting is such a difficult process for you. But the advertising world, it's very much going to be an issue of how you choose to frame, how you choose to promote your own site, what kind of ads you get, and also how choosy you want to be. We have been extremely choosy at ours. We try to be we try to be really faithful to our readers and make sure we aren't running ads that insult their intelligence. Certainly no punch the monkey kind of things. That's just a crime against humanity. And another point is we don't inundate our readers with ads. On the front page of ours has two ad units, period. And that's something I'm particularly proud of, because that's not very common, especially outside the realm of, CNN, who, they get a $500 CPM for their front page or something
they
like that.
They wish they got a $500 CPM.
Maybe not anymore, yeah.
Because my audience is like 99% women and 60% mothers, and women make most of the financial and household purchasing decisions, I feel like pretty much anything except Oracle or whatever could be advertising on my site. And so we've had, we had Nintendo, General Motors, Days of Our Lives, Guiding Light.
Guiding Light, yeah.
McDonald's, JCPenney, Dockers,
PBS right now. I mean, so like PBS, like advertising Super Y, which is a children's show, is I think perfect for my audience, but pretty much anything. You know, I'd like to see, you know, Pampers and, you know, diaper companies and toy companies and stuff like that, because that is something that I know my readers are buying anyway, and to, you know, introduce new products to them would be really great. But I also sell small ads below the fold for small, like, boutiques, children's boutiques, maternity lines, companies that can't afford to be at the top of the page but still interest my readers. So we kind of offer that kind of as a service in a way to let people know and also to support small businesses. So in the beginning, that's all I had. And now I don't have to focus on selling those ads, so I do sell some of them. But those are, you know, for small people, you know, for small blogs that are starting up, to sell ads to those kind of companies is a good way just to get yourself known in that community, because all those people know each other. Like, I go to trade shows and I just talk to people. And in the beginning, I thought, okay, I'm going to go there, I'm going to sell all these ads. And, you know, very few people buy ads like that. But, you know, I've just developed these great relationships with them. And we do giveaways and stuff like that. So that helps me in other ways. I may not be making money from it directly, but it helps my traffic and it increases loyalty.
Okay. We've got a bunch of people want to ask questions. Let me just ask you to kind of keep them brief so we can keep moving and get as many as we can. And I've got some themes I want to get back to, too. I guess we're on this side.
Hi, my name is John Schuster. And my blog is essentially an advertising for my own web design services. And I was just wondering what you've used to advertise to get people to come to your blogs.
How do you get readers?
Content. Don't waste money on marketing. Just, it's content. It's a content game. That's what keeps people. That's what brings them. It's what will make you remarkable. There's nothing else you can do, really, aside from content.
Well, I mean, there's certain things you can do to, you know, for SEO, but educate yourself about that. You know, put the important things in the title of posts. Like, simple things like that, but you'd be surprised how many people aren't doing it.
Okay, over here.
My question is directed, I guess, at everyone. Have you noticed in the last 2 months a decline in the advertising market? Because a number of people who have blogs in both publishing have been having some difficulty, especially in the B2B market.
It's seasonal.
It's seasonal, right? It's seasonal. I mean, typically, you know, Q4 is sort of the strongest quarter for advertising. Q1 in February, March is kind of slow, and it kind of picks up over the year. But, you know, that aside, you know, I haven't noticed anything. I don't know whether, I think the big thing is, you know, once you have a pretty strong brand, you're still going to keep some of those advertising dollars, even though the market may be shrinking a little bit. And I think that's the key, is trying to find a good brand and producing quality content, will keep the advertisers coming, I think.
Yeah. Over here.
Hi there. I'm Kellis Landrum. I run an art and design blog out in Los Angeles, and I've noticed as I go to a lot of art shows and design, culture, fashion-related events, there's a lot of companies that sponsor these events in Los Angeles, and I'm looking at when I see Scion's name sponsoring an art show, that seems to me like a natural for somebody who I should approach to sponsor my site. And I wondered if you guys had any tips for finding who the person is in an organization to talk to and how to approach them.
You guys all have other folks selling your ads for you, but you also do some kind of direct interaction with advertisers. Have you opened those doors in the past yourselves?
I find that a lot of times when you're doing a site for a while, you have marketing directors and PR agents coming to you trying to pitch you stories. And for me, that's been sort of the door into certain companies. Like, if you know, a PR person has gotten in touch with me about a product in the past, they're often the first person I will go to say I would like to talk to someone in marketing in your company, and usually they'll be happy to put you in touch. So.
Folks who reach out to you are natural targets, right? Absolutely. Over here.
Hi. I'm curious what other tools you may have used or found effective as your blogs have gained success, whether they were forums or social networking aspects, profiles, and so forth, what you found to be effective additional features.
I think the sense of community is is kind of integral to a lot of our sites. I know ours as well. Our forums have been a great, we use a software called vBulletin, and it's actually been a great source of getting ideas, running feedback, getting surveys, and I feel like that was one of my key points of that sort of helped me differentiate myself from my from other people is our forums grew really quickly, and we have something like, you know, we're not quite as big as ours, but, you know, 2 or 3 million pages a month, so it's a good community, and it's people you can rely on.
How much of it is organic, like set up the community and they'll come, and how much of it is you sitting down and kind of steering the conversation and jump-starting it? You or Ken, you've got some really active forums.
Yeah, for us, I think the whole approach to the community was that we wanted it to be authentic, not just something you slap on the back of your site and don't think about anymore. So we were very active, still are. I'm not nearly as active as I'd like to be.
Do you start the conversation? Do you get in there and drive it? What do you mean by active? Like, how do you participate?
No. You do a bit of everything, really. You actually will find that you won't have to start many conversations. Those happen on their own, and people will talk about things you would never imagine, you'd never think of.
Never admit you would imagine.
Yeah. And so the engagement issue is the most important one, which is that if people are at least ostensibly coming to, you know, the ARG Open Forum because of ARG-related content, you definitely need to be involved. You need to be talking to people, paying attention to what they think. You know, like Monish, it's an invaluable resource just from what you learn from your community alone. I'd say that forums are easily the most overlooked, under-monetized, and least respected aspect in this publishing business, and yet it is clearly the most valuable resource that any publication has that actually fosters community.
Let's talk about that for a minute, just on the terms of like how you get, you know, the content of what you're doing. I mean, Jill, for all the folks up here, Monish is cars and Max. Danielle is news about celebrity babies. Ken is tech. Your life and living and architecture and design and green, and you've got a kind of a broader remit, right? I mean, you're
we're ostensibly about design, but you know, design touches pretty much every aspect of life. So
yeah, so it's about life and the way people, you know, are or should be living it. What, tell us about the community, like who is in there and how do you hear from them and how do they work with you? How do they respond or interact with you?
The community is about 30 or 40% professional designers, and then the rest of it is kind of just more of a mainstream audience of people who are interested in design. And we're actually right now sort of actively trying to create more community services on the site. I mean, all we have at the moment is just comments, and we, you know, we have a lot of interest in our comments. We have tons of people writing in and having debates in the comments all the time. And I think, you know, I've been thinking about how we need to kind of take that a step further and provide more services and more ways for people to interact with each other on the site. So I'm hoping to get to that stage. It's just sort of a matter of, you know, finding the technology assistance to get to that and to implement it.
And the time in your schedule when you're running a business and running an editorial operation and everything else,
yeah.
Right? Let's talk about that for a minute. The content of your sites. I mean, Ken, you said like content is the one way to get readers in. You're all four known for really good content in the areas you're in. I mean, for Monish, it's partial. A lot of it is breaking news about the Mac industry, about cars being the first. Danielle is the same way. There's a lot of news about celebrities and their babies, but it's when you really break news first that you get the biggest kind of buzz out of it, right? How do you drive the quality of the content, especially as you go from being one person doing this on your own and deciding you know when something's good to literally sitting here on a panel while you know other people are writing stuff for your site? How do you keep the content high enough? You've done it because your sites are all growing really well, but how do you make sure it's right? How do you sleep at night knowing somebody else is doing stuff on your website? Any of you?
To get back to the community issue.
I mean last night when you didn't sleep because you're in Austin, but generally how do you sleep at night?
Yeah, no, the community is again, for us at least, absolutely essential. Because if you pay attention to their feedback, what they want, you leverage the community. Everyone who works for ours actually was a reader first. We didn't go out and hire J-School grads. We didn't do anything like that. We just brought people up from our own community. And our community demands a lot from us, and we take our beatings when we mess stuff up. And that is essential, I think, is being in a position where the readers care about the quality of the content as much as you do. Because then you can hire as many editors as you want. You'll never beat, 6 million people reading your site who are very technical. I mean, when we write about NASA, we get emails from people at the Jet Propulsion Laboratories. You
screwed up a detail in the 45th paragraph.
and they're very upset about it.
Yeah.
but it's invaluable to have those kind of readers. And the only way you'll ever get those kind of readers is by paying a lot of attention to what your readership wants and what they think.
I have a lot of, I can never keep track of all our contributors, maybe 20 or maybe 30 with our reviewers. And I put almost all of them through a really rigorous audition process to make sure that they got it and understood. I wouldn't even respond to people who didn't answer, the basic questions or include certain things in their audition pieces. And now I have these two full-time people. And the first one has been with me the longest, and I mean, she most of the time does like an amazing job, but every now and then I have to be like, what were you thinking? So, I mean, I can be here and I know the site is running itself. I can go on vacation, but they're all readers. Every now and then I would open up the site to say, hey, if you want to write for us, email us with a few stories that are in our style that we haven't covered yet, blah, blah, blah. But, as you go along, you get people coming to you who are, just past writers or they already have those skills and they're just looking for either a new hobby or a new job, so they'll come to you. But
do you ever hit the site and go, oh my God, this has to come down right now and just kill something? Not this week.
I mean, there are, issues like with Jamie Lynn Spears' pregnancy. There's, kind of like we had a lot of people that were complaining when we first posted that she was pregnant. She's Britney Spears' 16-year-old sister who's pregnant.
Heard, yeah.
And so a lot of people, when we first posted that, they're saying, oh, you're glorifying teen pregnancy and blah, blah, blah. Or like one of the remarks in the announcement was, she's taking responsibility and having the baby. Well, actually, a lot of people disagreed about that. Like, is she really being responsible? Blah, blah, blah. So we weren't... the next time there was a picture of her, she's been hiding out in Louisiana. My editor was like, should we even run this? Because people were complaining last time. So I asked people, I did a poll, and 11,000 people said, yes, they want to see it. I mean, like 70% of 11,000 people said they want to see it. So
just getting 11,000 people to care enough to try to help shape the content of your site.
I find that polls are a really good way to gauge people's opinion, because not everybody wants to comment. We have type key, so you have to like register for that, or you have to enter an email address or whatever, and that takes a couple of steps. So a poll is really easy to gauge, and they can't they can only vote one time, so that's a good way to gauge opinion.
That's great. Let me go to this gentleman over here.
Hi. I read a couple of your guys' blogs every day, and one thing I wanted to say with ours, I'm really glad that you guys have like a physics guy on your staff, because it's kind of been sort of a doorway to physics.
Are you the guy from NASA who keeps finding stuff in their stories as well?
Yeah, I mean, they have a fantastic physics guy who just like really makes physics understandable for everybody. But my question is, I don't really have a blog, but if I wanted to go into it, obviously I'd want to do something I'm passionate about, but would I want to have like a really like a wide, broad range of topics that like covering a lot of different things, or do I want to really have a specialized, narrow focus for a blog? I mean, what would be better in a sort of a potential profit sort of way?
Have you guys, to take that a little bit further, have you experimented with, should I be narrowly focused? Should I broaden out? Am I going too wide or too narrow? I mean, is it something you wrestle with as you try to shape the business? No, Jill?
I think that's always an issue, and in theory, I really believe that the more narrow your niche is and the more focused it is, the better you will be, the more successful you'll be. When I first started my site, Green Design, I thought, is there even an audience for this? I mean, people don't even know what Green Design means. Still, to this day, a lot of times I find people don't understand whether or not we're just a green site or whether or not we're a design site. And I kind of try to tell people we're both. It's both of those things overlapping each other. That's what we're about. That said, though, sometimes, you know, a niche can be very, very narrow, and we've certainly experimented with, when we started, we were really just covering home design, architecture, and interiors, and we've definitely expanded over the past couple of years in terms of, we cover fashion now, we've been looking at automobiles, products, and things that we weren't originally covering, and I think that's been good for us, but you know, the wider you go, the harder it is to define what it is you're talking about. So I think it's very important to kind of try to maintain a balance so you always know what your the mission of your site is.
A related point, too, is, I mean, the way we look at it at ours is we constrict the focus of the site based on the expertise available to us. So in a way, I would say you should really just, you should cover whatever you can speak with authority. That those are the things that you should cover, because there's way too much utterly craptastic content online, and just don't make more of it.
You know, have you scaled back at all? Have you started to go in certain directions and said, ours is not going to do this, we're just not capable of it?
We have it. We actually got our start as a very, very focused hardware site. We were the guys who would tell you how to clip a pin off a CPU so you could bypass the phase lock loop and run a CPU at any arbitrary speed that you felt, well, not completely arbitrary. I'm getting off topic. so that's where we started. And, yeah, I mean, what happened when we decided to start covering science, it was because we had three guys in our communities, all postdocs, all very strongly educated science guys, and they wanted to do it. And so then you're like, well, you know, this guy's got a postdoc in biological medicine applications for the heart. I think he knows what he's talking about. And so then we ran with it.
But, you told me this the other day. You're not sort of satisfied to be doing ours plus science. You're out there to actually kick the science site's butts every day, right? You're beating all the journals and all that kind of stuff on things that are...
Because science journalism suffers from the problem that I think technology journalism often suffers from too, which is that the people writing the content aren't always completely. They don't know exactly what it is they're talking about. They're speaking out of press releases and
very subtle way to put it. Yeah.
Very superficial understandings of the technology, and
usually based on what somebody else just wrote about the same thing. Right?
Yeah, often. Yeah.
Anybody else? Have you kind of, Manish? You're doing cars, but cars is a big area, right? Do you find yourself kind of switching focus or trying to pick areas that you're best at?
Yeah. You know, I mean, on any given day, you can write about, you know, Jay-Z driving his new Hummer or whatever, or you could actually try to stay focused. And what we've done is on the Left Lane side, we stick to the car manufacturers and the specs and the actual car rather than sort of the more sensational stories. And sometimes those sensational stories will sort of drive traffic. And we've considered sort of adding a back page where stories that, you know, aren't necessarily stories but are fun to read.
Naked celebrities caught in expensive cars.
Exactly. yeah. Things like that, yeah. So it's always...
Danielle can help you with, by the way. You guys work together on that.
So I think trying to expand content to draw readers and then trying to stay focused and talk about things intelligently are two competing sort of... competing visions where, you know, you definitely want to write about something because you know it's going to bring some traffic in and maybe some good readers, but you don't want to sort of get off topic too much.
Is that the conflict of being both the CEO and the chief editor?
Actually, I'm not the editor. I'm more of a publisher now. But it is a conflict between me and my editor is, you know, what can we write about intelligently, as Ken said, but how much content we should be putting up.
We've had to eliminate some categories like marriages and deaths, unless it's like Heath Ledger, you know, famous celebrity parent dying. Because otherwise, we would just, you know, that would be another blog for us writing about, you know, I mean, because almost everybody, you know, is a parent. So you could conceivably write about anything. Also, some other blogs that are focused on celebrity parents or babies will just have pictures of the parents on their own. without the kids? I mean, if someone's not pregnant, I mean, what sets that apart from any other site?
It's so just, you're just generic celebrity news at that point.
Yeah. So we decided, or I decided a while ago, not to do that. But on the same hand, we're expanding because, you know, initially it was just about, you know, news and who's being born and who's pregnant. And we've gone into fashion and gear because, you know, it's kind of logical. We show a photo. People want to know, what kind of stroller is that? What shoes are they wearing? Where can I get those jeans? So we'll cover that. And then last year, a year and a half ago, I launched a review site that, you know, I'm not trying to be the biggest, best review site, but we provide that because our readers are interested in it. And we have a way to review things that, or talk about things that celebrities are not necessarily wearing. So they like that. But we, you know, we try not to get too much into the parenting thing, giving advice, because there's so many other sites that are out there that do it much better. So we just kind of realize, you know, we'll talk about parenting things as it relates to celebrity stories, like Elizabeth Hasselbeck talking about mastitis. Like, I'm not going to do a story about mastitis, but here she is talking about it, so that's a good excuse to, you know, have some sort of parenting information.
As long as it's in your field. Let's go over here.
Yeah, so back at, I did zines back before the World Wide Web existed, and I've done a couple blogs on a couple different topics that at some point when they get large enough, generating content really requires that it stops being just a one man or one woman kind of setup, and you start having to have people contribute. And one of the things I always found was that it was very difficult to sort out who was going to be a good contributor, who was going to be on time and write good copy, or, you know, write good material, and who was going to kind of flake out and disappear on you and stuff like that. And I was wondering if you guys could comment a little bit about that process of finding the good folks and sort of filtering out the bad folks, and maybe how do you deal with when you have somebody who kind of goes bad?
How do you manage them once you already have them on board? I mean, Danielle, you talked about the audition process a little bit of getting people in the first place.
Yeah, initially it was really rigorous. I would make people go through like a month or so of submitting about 10 stories a week because I wanted to know that, yeah, I mean, everybody who says they want to contribute is really excited in the beginning, and then everybody kind of peters off. So I would put them through this, you know, I mean, I would post their stuff so they were being published, but before I actually introduced them to my my readers as a new staff person, I would make sure they were doing that. But we've still had people that after that process, they still do it. So I get them to commit to a certain amount of posts. Whatever they want is fine, but if it's 2 posts a week, that's fine, or if it's 20 posts a week. But if they're not doing it, I say, hey, what's going on? Like, are you just not interested anymore? And I don't have the time to support everybody, whether I'm paying them or not. So,
have you had people you just dumped and said, this isn't working, goodbye?
We've had people we tried coaching that just did not respond to coaching. So we kind of said, like, or I kind of said, you know, it looks like, you know, you're not really interested in this, so, you know, thank you for your time, and I hope you'll keep reading the site and feel free to contribute in the future, but right now, it's not working out.
Right now, you're useless. Anybody else? I mean, Jill, tell us about getting contributors, other people to write for you.
It's always been somewhat of a challenge. I mean, there seems to be an endless supply of people who are interested, but, you know, as we've sort of been talking about already here, not that many of those interested people actually have kind of the stamina or the real interest that to make it, to be doing it consistently for many months at a time. So, you know, we have a screening process that we put people through as well. And, you know, the way I've sort of managed it is that, you know, we've had a lot of good writers that things have come up in their life where, you know, they've been a great writer for 9 months or whatever, and then they hit thesis time in their grad school, and I don't hear from them for a year. So I just, you know, I'm pretty understanding with the fact that that's just how people's lives go, and there's always someone else who wants to contribute. So for me, I've just, you know, when people have kind of reached that point and they can't they can't contribute to the site anymore. We just kind of have them on hiatus, and if they want to come back, they're welcome to. And then there's always someone new who wants to write for the site. So that's just kind of how I work it.
And I find that paying people really helps keep them around.
Yeah.
Define that paying people. Is it like a dollar a post? Is it $1,000 a week? I mean, what
no,
it take
I mean,
to
I'm,
get
pay,
somebody to
I'm
do
paying
work?
My regular news writers $5 a post. And I pay some other people by the hour, like $10 to $15 an hour. And then my features person gets paid like $100, $150. I have a photographer who I'm paying like half of her daily rate now. But I mean, the most important thing is just to, you know, if you want to keep people around, and one way to keep them not being flaky is just to thank them as often as possible, send them little gifts like $10 Dunkin' Donuts card really goes a long way, to showing people that you appreciate them, because a lot of times people feel like they're not being appreciated and, you know, oh, why do I have to do this? You know, I'm helping them grow their, you know, their dream. It's not my dream. I don't care as much. So. Things
That's
like
great.
That.
Let's go over here.
Hi, I'm a journalist, and I'm actually both excited and terrified by what you guys are doing to news. And so my question is...
doing with news, we like to say.
Right, with news. And my question is, as you expand and have more resources, do you find yourself wanting to do what you might call traditional journalism, which could include a lot of research and calling people and getting quotes and all that? Or do you find you don't even need to do that because you have experts speaking on topics that they already know well, be that babies or physics?
Or are you, in fact, already doing that now?
Yeah, I mean, at ours, we're already doing that. Our principle is that we want to deliver accurate information that's very insightful. So there's an analytical piece that the expertise comes in with, but, You find out pretty quickly, especially once you get kind of largish, that you've got to reach out to people and maintain relationships and do that kind of stuff. So we do it, but it's even when we do it, it's not traditional journalism because we still have a very biased voice. I mean, we don't try to pretend that we're not biased. I mean, everyone has a biased voice. There's no such thing as objective.
Biased in what sense? You know. Not biased to Dell because they're advertising on your site.
Right. It's biased in that we will take a stand and we'll say these are our positions. We try to be very transparent about our biases. We'll always do that regardless of how many calls we're taking or, you know, meetings we're holding with people in the news.
I think in some way what makes blogs interesting and different from traditional media outlets is the fact that they have some sort of perspective. And for example, with my site, the first 10 writers we had, and most of our writers still are people with a design background. They're actually architects and product designers. They're not people with journalistic training. So I think that's a benefit to us. I mean, certainly it makes things challenging sometimes from the perspective of like proofreading and editing and fact checking, but it also, it makes the quality of the writing different, and it means that we have a kind of unique perspective and a voice in our articles that is not this is going to be the same thing that you find in like the New York Times or in a Shelter magazine. So,
how does the reader know that something one of you has done is accurate, well-researched, correct? What gives them that sense of faith that is actually as good as something that a professional journalist would have done? Obviously, you've all got respect. You've got readers who respect you and come back to the site over and over, and you get more and more readers. So the presumption is they trust you, but why?
We always show our sources at the bottom. And when we start doing more original, exclusive stuff like celebrity photography, our own doing shoots with them. So, I mean, then obviously that's kind of like, all right, that's real because this person is posing for this photo and answering it. And a lot of blogs don't. They just, you know, they'll just say so-and-so is pregnant. And someone emails us and they say, is this true? And we go there and we're like, where are they getting this information from? Unless I see a link from a reliable source, I'm not going to trust it. So I don't know. I think my readers know that we're not going to say something unless we really believe it to be true. So even if it's a rumor, we're only going to publish the rumors, identifying them as rumors that we think have a good chance of being true.
And explaining where you got them.
And they've been, you know, a lot of my readers have been with me for 4 years, so they know that, you know, we're not fly by night, that we're consistent in, you know, how we treat a lot of things. And also, you know, they keep coming back to the site because of our voice. I mean, we are we really try to be objective and not take positions on things, and let our readers say what they have to say in the comments, and we may agree with them, but we don't take a stance. So I think that makes us more authentic in the reader's eyes.
Okay, let's go over here.
Hi. I work with an image provider company that basically provides free content for bloggers, publishers in general, related to celebrity and editorial subjects. And I wonder, what will be the main source that you use for images? Because I believe, especially you, Daniel, that it's kind of crucial for your audience to visualize the content.
Well, in the beginning, we did what Perez Hilton did, which was just take images from everybody else. But then as the budget allowed for it, we started making deals with the photo agencies to license their images. So I would say 90% of our images are licensed, and the other 10% are, well, no, maybe part of that is our own photography, but a small amount is just thumbnails linking to other sites with that image that, you know, we can't buy. But I spend several thousand dollars a month to license the images.
I mean, Manish, photos are obviously a huge part of the car journalism business, right?
Yeah, it's actually really interesting because, you know, when you start the spy shots, end up driving a lot of traffic. And
this being like the first picture of a car that hasn't been released yet.
Exactly. Yeah. Or, you know, yesterday a white Camaro surfaced, you know, somewhere in Phoenix, I think. Can't really say where. But the buying content, you know, as we get larger, you know, I'm beginning to realize that we need to focus on acquiring original content, and these pictures are very valuable, and there's only a few people out there that actually can do this or that see the new Camaro or know where it is. So we've focused a lot on trying to secure longer term contracts on these pictures because they're very valuable to our readers.
And they get used to you being the one who's got them first.
Yeah, right? Absolutely.
Okay, let's go over here.
I have kind of a macro question. I've been an art director for a couple regional magazines out of Phoenix, and you see the process and the editors.
Have you seen a white Camaro?
No, I think it got scooped, I guess, but now it's up. I see the process that the editors go through and just cultivating stories and these kind of things. It's all coming from the web anyways. And I guess I'm wondering with you guys, what's your personal kind of development in seeing that the terms are wrong, that you guys aren't bloggers, that you are now writers and journalists, and the level of quality varies. But I think the language of posts is actually... It should be dated, and that way you guys are writing articles, and you are stepping up.
Are you journalists? If I accuse you of being a journalist, is that a compliment? Is that an insult? Is that am I misunderstanding what you do?
I think at the end of the day, being or not being a journalist is primarily defined whether or not you're going to hide behind a shield law when you're sued. Otherwise, I don't see any point in having that fight.
And would you?
I absolutely would. I absolutely would. Yeah.
I actually have, so yes.
So I've gotten more cease and desist letters from Apple than I've gotten thank you mails from fans. It's a really touchy issue for some people how you brand yourself. If you call yourself a blogger, that means certain things to certain people, both positive and negative. We at ours actually I guess in 1998, people were using the word blog and blogging, but it wasn't on my radar then, and we've actually never identified ourselves that way.
When you go to, if you're at a trade show, CES or something, you're there with press passes, right?
Right.
And Manish, I know you are too at the auto shows.
Yeah, it's interesting. I went to CES, and they had both blogger badges and they had press badges, and I didn't know which one to take, so I took both. And I, but it was interesting because some of the PR folks didn't treat the blog badge the same as they treated the press badge, and we had different rooms, different press rooms from blog rooms. I'm not sure what they were trying to get at there, but I mean, I think at the end of the day, you know, when you do go to a trade show with a press pass or a blog pass, you're really looking for sort of stories and understanding the products that people are, you know, that you're going to write about.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting. One of
company that we reviewed and just known for a while told me that this front page of the business section of the New York Times article, like including photos of them and coverage of their company, got as much traffic as a review on my site.
There you go. So let's talk about these businesses you've started. What's the biggest challenge, either recently or ahead of you? Like, where do you take it from here? What aside from the fact that somebody's writing stuff under your name while you're here, what keeps you up at night about what's going to happen next? Are you worried about when you're going to burn out on doing this? You're worried about when you're going to have to go to the next level and not be able to afford it? Are you branching out? I know, Jill, you've kind of branched out into physical events beyond the site itself.
Yeah.
Where do you go from here with the businesses?
Well, I think the biggest challenge for me is kind of trying to maintain live-work balance and also just trying to kind of consistently remember why I started it in the first place. Because for me, it's, you know, I'm a blogger, but I've also sort of become a small business entrepreneur. I mean, I run every aspect of the business from the accounting to, like, you know, the HR to the taxes, the tech support. So when you have all those different tasks to take care of, sometimes you can kind of lose track of why you started it in the first place and what you're really passionate about. So, of course, the more people that we bring on to work with, the more concerned I become about finances and making sure that we have enough money coming in. But that wasn't my purpose in starting it in the beginning. It wasn't just to make money. So I think for me, the struggle is just kind of constantly keeping in mind our original reason for existence and trying to outsource and get other people to do some of the tasks that aren't really the kind of main drivers behind the site.
And is the live-work balance better or worse when your spouse is also a professional blogger?
I think for me, the live-work balance has been really challenging since the beginning. And it actually was easier when, my husband is also a blogger, and it was one of the inspirations for me in starting my site in the first place. And
you should mention him, since a couple people have seen his site.
Yeah, he's sitting over there. His name is Peter Rojas. He started Gizmodo and Engadget. And when we were both blogging full-time, it was actually a little bit easier because we both were running around like crazy, staying up really late. And now he's got a new startup, which is operates on a totally different schedule, which is kind of more of a, you know, 9 to 5, needing to work with people during the day and not staying up till 2 a.m. blogging. So I think he's found that quite a challenge from my perspective.
So they complain about each other's schedules.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One of my challenges, I mean, having a 9 to 5 schedule is really good for me. Now that my husband's staying home, it had to change a little bit to accommodate his need to write and work on his own stuff. And of course, for me to spend time with my daughter, because that's one of the benefits of working from home, having your own business. But it's when I'm not officially working that's the challenge for me in the life-work balance, because I'm always thinking about the site, because I love it. I love, like, going to work every day, but I have a hard time stopping.
Yeah.
So I think when you have your own business, it's really hard to, you know, turn that switch off. And a lot of times I'll be sitting with my daughter and she's just like building walls with her Legos. And I'm just thinking like, oh God, there's like 15 things I could be doing right now. But, you know, she's only 2.5 once. And okay, I really want to be with her and she loves being with me. But the thing about, you know, growing or whatever, I think it's important sometimes just to kind of do what you're doing and keep doing it and not think about like growing massively, you know, like it's okay to just kind of keep on trucking and, you know, say, okay, in 6 months I'm going to make some sort of change. But I'm always looking, you know, I'd like to have more staff so I can make sure that we are covering something the second it comes out and there's not hours going between things, posting.
But that's a great point. It's okay to say like my life is okay today and I don't need to grow the business 10% in the next 24 hours or feel like I'm a failure?
Yeah, I mean, I have not done anything actively to grow my traffic, and I realize it went up 75. It's been up 75% since June.
Guys, I apologize. We're gonna get kicked out of the room here shortly. We have not have time for the last couple of questions. Given those challenges, have you had those moments where you just kind of say, I'm giving up, this is it, I need to get rid of this thing, I need to go, you know, back to working at Dunkin' Donuts? Are you so passionate about this that you know you're going to do it forever? Do you sometimes wake up and just want to walk away?
I'm not passionate about the subject anymore, but I'm passionate about my life, having the kind of lifestyle I have now. So that keeps me going. And I love, you know, trying to just do new things to run my business. So I think for me, it's just being an entrepreneur that I enjoy the most.
I want to body slam my business all the time. I tear my hair out. I flip out. I freak out. I go crazy almost every day. And I'm not on medication. I probably should be. But for us, at least, ours is such a passionate thing that you do throw your hands up in the air all the time because you set your goals on purpose beyond what you can reach. But sometimes it's really frustrating when you don't, you know, you don't hit what you want to hit.
I think there was a point in, you know, 2001 where I didn't know whether I could sustain myself. Advertising market dried up, and thank God AdSense came along. But there was a point where I considered going back to graduate school. But since then, you know, my biggest challenge is trying to figure out how to manage growth and how to keep quality, you know, how to sort of keep innovating. And we spent a lot of time, me and my staff, trying to figure out what we could be doing better and how we can be doing it better given our resources. And competing against the big boys now, you know, is something that we think about almost on a daily basis.
Great. Well, Jill, Ken, Danielle, Monish, thank you very much. We're going to be here for a little bit. If you want to come up and ask those last questions, feel free. Thanks, everybody.